Welcome to this week's episode of Electric Podcast. I'm Fred Lambert, your host, and I'm joined by Seth Winchell. How are you, Seth?
I'm good, Fred.
Awesome. So I just came back from Abu Dhabi yesterday, where I went to the first official media drive for the Audi e-tron. So it's not our full review of the car. We're going to need to spend a little bit more time with it to have a better idea. But the first drive gave us a pretty good experience to talk about the car. And we're going to start with that this week. Starting with, the design itself, because I think it's noteworthy. We haven't seen many EVs look like the e-tron, really. And we've seen it in person. Was it 2 months ago when they launched it in San Francisco? We've been seeing it with the camouflage that Audi is very fond of, apparently, for over a year now. But we saw it completely unveiled a few months back, and it looked pretty good. But now I got the opportunity to see it on the road, see it like in the context that most people are gonna see the car. And it is it's a stunning vehicle, really. It's a very good looking. I think the proportions are like perfect for an SUV of that size, which is sort of a mid-sized SUV. I know how they use like the letter of the each segment, but let's just call it a mid-sized SUV. They had a bunch of different color paint there. I drove the beige one, which I'm not really fond of. It is beige.
The white and red look pretty good.
Yeah. The white looks awesome. The blue and red also looks pretty good. And the exterior, like I said, proportion looks great. It looks like a solid premium SUV. The design is not that different from anything you've seen from other like the Q5 or the Q8 or all of these other SUVs. In the interior of the car, it's very much like the latest generation of Audi. Like the I think the most recently updated interior is like the A5 or the A6. I'm not sure. I'm not very familiar with Audi's gas powered lineup, but you have the two screen set up it's three screen, though the third one, that's a lower one, is mainly locked for all the EC and the seat stuff, so it's not interactive as much as the two main screens where you have your navigation system and you have all the settings and everything. I mean, in terms of the UI, so we're talking about the screen, being a Tesla owner, I very much got used to the Spartan, very minimalist interior. Everything is on the touchscreen, and the user interface is very user-friendly, almost like iPad-like, really. And now when I get into cars that have like tons of buttons, and although it's very much touchscreens based in this one, so it's not as bad as like the Mercedes or something like that. But I got used to it now that when I get into other user interface, I'm always a little bit it needs a period to adapt, really. And of course, other than actual user interface, the premium interior is like the interior is like what you're gonna see in a great premium car. The seats are awesome. They even have the massage seat where they give you a massage, which is pretty good.
You don't have to put quarters in there or anything, right?
No, and it's not. Also, it's not. I thought it would be gimmicky, but you know, when you sit in a very good massage chair, like the $3,000+ one, which they still have some torque to it, like some force. It's similar to that. Like it's still pretty good. And when you're in traffic or something, like you're not doing much, it's really appreciated to get a good massage out of it.
And the interior is pretty similar to other Audis. So like if you're an Audi person, an Audi driver, the interior is going to be familiar, right?
Absolutely. It's going to be, it's indistinguishable. Is that it? Is that a word?
Indistinguishable.
Aside from the new virtual mirror that you have. So
those are cool.
We were driving the early European production version. So I was with the US group for the US media drive, but they don't have US cars yet. So they sent out a bunch of early European production version. And in Europe, you're going to have the camera replacing the side mirrors as an option. You can still get the regular mirrors. But in America, that won't be an option, at least for now. Audi said that they are lobbying to try to make it happen. But until the law changes and you can get mirrors and screens and cameras and screens instead of mirrors, that won't be an option until then. Speaking of that, with a day of driving, so we drove for maybe like 2 or 3 hours in the morning, 2 or 3 hours in the afternoon. It's not enough to get used to the virtual mirrors things, because I mean, all our lives we drive cars and we're used to looking through the window, and even though like the screens are like very close to where the mirror would be, it's still like 3 or 4 inches down. And it's, as soon as you turn your head, you have the reflex to look through the window at the mirrors. But now you have to look not through the window, but at the door, because it's embedded inside the door. It's not very natural to do, but I'm sure it's something that you can get used to. And like, I don't know, like if you, just like the Model 3 when not having an instrument cluster in front of you, having to look like a few inches to your right. It's the exact same thing. You get used to it in like a few days, I assume. It's something we'll have maybe to get back to you once we get the longer term review of the car. But yeah, other than that, pretty great. In terms of the driving experience, I mean, most of our driving was on the highway, which is going to be most people driving anyway. And the experience was very smooth. The cabin is extremely quiet, very well done on this front.
I mean, Audi's used to trying to quiet down internal combustion engines and keeping them very quiet.
Yeah.
So this must be like super easy for them.
Yeah. Some wind noise, some tire noise. The tire noise was basically maybe the most that you could hear. So they did a great job on this front. Speaking of driving on the highway, the e-tron is equipped. Well, it's optional, but you can get the driver assist system, which is a level 2 system comparable to Tesla's autopilot. So we're talking about adaptive cruise control, auto steering, that stuff. In my experience, it worked flawlessly. You activate them a lot like the autopilot, just with the cruise control stock. And it keeps you in the lane. You can choose a driving distance, like number of cars between you and the car driving in front. And it works both with camera system. And you have a LiDAR embedded in the front of the bumper.
Yeah. You mentioned this in the post. The roads there are pretty pristine, though, so it wasn't really like kind of a hard terrain to map, so to speak.
Yeah. The conditions were perfect. Really, the markings on the road are very good in Abu Dhabi. I wasn't sure why they were bringing us to Abu Dhabi for this. I thought it was like a weird place, a place far away to go, even from a German standard, like from Germany, it's not that close either. So, once you get there, you see, well, first of all, during the winter, the weather is perfect for driving an electric vehicle if you want to get your efficiency as best as you can, because we know that the cold is the enemy of the EV. But also the roads are just perfect there. They have fairly recent roads. Since they were all built during the oil boom. And so the Audi driver assist system did benefit from the clear markings on the road. Kept the car very much in the center lane. Not much of ping-ponging between the lines. And I did get a few like all the steering wheel alerts, much like autopilot, because you also have to apply some torque to the wheel in order for it to detect your hands. But Audi did say that in the US version, they're going to have a different sensor. And that sensor is going to be able to detect even just like one finger being pressed on the wheel. So it should be easier to just like put your hand on the wheel and let the system drive on the highway, which is pretty fun. What else? Oh, yeah, the regen. Can speak about the regen too. I didn't like the user interface for the regen on the car, because it's using, you can choose automatic or manual, And manual system, basically, which automatic, you know, you're going to try to optimize the range, the rigidity braking for you, which every car has, basically. Some of them you can choose, like, some kind of strength. You can have it weaker or stronger, depending on on your preference. But as most experienced EV drivers, you just want it to be as strong as possible. You want to be able to just adapt your own driving to maximum potential for regenerative braking, just to be more efficient and to get more range out of the car. So I thought that I'll put it to manual, but then you put it to manual, and the only thing that it does is that you can change the regen strength with two paddles that you have on the steering wheel. But it's not like the bolt where you have the paddle that just it adds more regen power as you press it. It changed the limit of the regen that it can do. So you don't have to press on it when you want to regen more. You press on it to increase the potential for more regen.
Yeah, Hyundai's got a similar system.
Yeah,
don't like it.
No, me neither. And
I kind of like what Chevy does, but they have it kind of backwards. But you hit drive and you hit L and you go down to a different level, yeah. And then you have a paddle, and that paddle is actually like a brake.
That's the best system. Or you don't really need to have like the two different drive mode. You could just put like Tesla does, which low or normal.
You're not going to be switching it so often.
Yeah, exactly. On the steering wheel. Exactly. But same thing for that. Like I just put the regen to maximum on the pedal, then on the paddle, and then I didn't touch the paddle at all later on. But other than that, though, the regen is great because it's extremely smooth, and the transition between the hydraulic brakes and the regen brakes. So you really don't feel the difference in any time, and you because of that you think like, oh yeah, they're not using regen enough then, but they are, because you can feel it at higher speed. You feel the difference a lot. It's just at low speed, it's very smooth transition. And most of our driving was on the highway, but we also went up a mountain, and that was cool because for that part they gave us an iPad in the car. And the iPad was directly linked, had a live link to the powertrain, and you could see the torque of the wheel and the energy that it was that we were sending to the wheel. Then the wheel was getting back from the regen, and so we could see exactly where the motor has to drive. Like if you're looking on YouTube right now, you could see a little bit on the map here. Like the yellow section is where we were at. Sending energy to the motor. No, sorry about that.
Oh, shit. So what was the highest level in kilowatts of regen that you saw?
I didn't get the kilowatt. They were talking about Gs. They said the highest was 0.3 Gs of deceleration that you can get.
That's not
really super helpful. But
no, that's not a huge amount.
It's pretty big, I think, 0.3.
Well, it's such a big car that slowing down that huge of a car by even 0.3 Gs is probably pretty impressive.
Well, if we look at the energy capacity, though. I don't like how they put it together, because that was like an hour. So that includes also like, So we started out with 34.8 kilowatt hour of total energy capacity before starting up the mountain. Then we drove up the mountain. I think we got down. No, they don't put the number here. Well, once we ended the drive, we're at 22. So they said a total energy use of 13 kilowatt hour. But that included a total recuperation of 6.3. I think if you actually look like before, like once we get to the top, the number is not here, but I think we use like 9 kilowatt hour to get up the mountain, and we recuperated about 6 going down.
That's solid.
That's a lot of
recuperation. Depending on how steep then. Yeah.
But we did drive very slowly, like we just didn't touch anything and just let it go all the way down. So it took like a while to get down the mountain. but it showed really the potential for recuperation there. The charging, so that's one thing I liked about the Audi Media Drive. They did show you the charging of the car. It's not like a lot of other EV drive when you, I know you experienced this with the Jaguar. And
Jaguar was particularly weird about that.
Same thing with Nissan. Within the drive, like as soon as it's time to charge the car, someone picks up your car and the car goes away and then comes back and magically charge. And like all the journalists, they just don't talk about the charging. At least...
Yeah, it was very weird at Jaguar as well. Yeah. Like they... Like we would have lunch and we'd have new cars and they would be charged and we'd like, how did that happen? Yeah. And they're like, one person told me that they actually had a huge diesel generator, like following the reporters that would charge the cars.
Well, they had a generator for the Audi one too, but I mean, it's just halfway through our drive where we ended up having lunch. So they makes it so it's still convenient, but. Let's assume you're not in Abu Dhabi in the middle of the desert where we stop at a random zoo out in nowhere and they decide to charge it here because they wanted us to have like a off-road experience during lunch. So we had lunch at the zoo and the zoo is still under construction. So there's like big trails where we can go off-road, if you will. So they wanted us to stop there and there's just no charging at the random zoo being built at in Abu Dhabi. So they brought a generator with a fast charging station and they charged the car there, which is fair. I mean, I know that for most use case, it won't be a generator that was going to supply the energy capacity. But you still want to for people to understand what's the experience of charging there. And so they did a demonstration of the charger. They didn't let you... You're not going to sit there and watch the car charge for half an hour or something. But they show you the plug. They show you everything. And what I saw, the car going up to 135 kilowatts for charging, which is the highest I have ever seen a passenger car being charged at that point. They said it goes up to 150 kilowatts. In this case, they said that the limiting factor was the charging station that they had there didn't have an active cooling cable. So that was limiting to 135 kilowatts. But if you have a liquid-cooled cable like Electrify America has for the 250 station, then each one should be able to get up to 150. And the program manager there for the Audi said that we should be pretty impressed by the capacity of the e-tron to get 250 very fast if your state of charge is relatively low and then maintain it like a long time throughout the charging session, which of course we know is
that was Matt, right?
Yeah, that was Matthew. Yeah,
he actually told me that it would go over 150.
He didn't tell me that, but he said something like you can get 150 up to like 80% charge.
Oh wow!
So that would be good because then you get there at like I don't know like 30 miles. And you get to 100 and you get...
That's a really quick charge.
Yeah, you get close to like 180 in less than 30 minutes and then you just leave. You don't wait for that other 20% unless you absolutely need it. But and you might need it because the range is probably the limiting factor here when we talk about the e-tron because it's not a very efficient car. So we've been raving about it so far. The main downside is the efficiency of the e-tron. The car that we got, it was 100% in the morning, state of charge, and it was showing 323 kilometers, which is about 200 miles. That's not that big.
Not for a 95 kilowatt hour battery.
No, that's the thing, right? It still has a big battery pack. Though it looked like it was fairly accurate if you do some combining of like city driving and highway driving. But then if you just do highway driving, I think we have gotten much less than 200 miles, probably closer to like 185, 160, 190 maybe if we would have been a little bit more efficient about driving because the efficiency was showing after like a few hours of driving 32 kilowatt hour per 100 kilometers. So that would have added up, if you divided that by the 95 kilowatt hour capacity, 297 kilometers, so 185 miles of highway driving.
And you're going how fast on the highway?
Yeah, that's the thing. over 120 kilometers an hour on average, I'd say. Because in Abu Dhabi, you can get up to 160, actually, but that's like very from small section. Most of the driving is around 140, but you really cannot exceed the speed limit there. They have radars everywhere, and they can put you in jail for speeding and everything. So you're really limited under that. So 120 and 140 kilometers an hour was most over driving, which is the equivalent of 75 to 87 miles per hour. So it's not excessive. It's you can drive that in the U.S. too, and depending on the state and depending just how fast you're willing to go versus the speed limit. But yeah, it's a bit disappointing. But so a bunch of people have been saying like, oh, Audi, it's because Audi doesn't have the technology that Tesla has. Tesla is just a much more efficient powertrain. And maybe they do. But I don't think it's that technology improvements from Tesla would explain the entire difference here. I think it might explain some difference, like maybe a 10%, but like there's a 20 to 30% difference in efficiency depending on how you look at the numbers here. I don't think that Tesla has that much of a leap here in terms of technology. I think they didn't want to make some compromises in terms of the design mainly. So it is a lot less aerodynamic than the Model X, for example, even though it's...
Did they give you a coefficient of drag?
They did. Well, they didn't give it this time, but they did last time. And if I remember, it's the 0.27.
So not horrible, but...
No, it's pretty good because they did some great improvement, like the side mirror. Side mirror just shave a point right there. People are complaining about the grill. The grill is not that bad. The grill is mostly covered. They have some louver, though, for active cooling with air cooling for like the brakes. And also, it redirects air from the grill to the underbody of the car. And the underbody of the car is completely covered. So that also had some aerodynamic performance. So it's the grill is not that bad here for the aerodynamics. But the shape itself is just... It's more conventional for SUV. It doesn't have like the egg shape of the Model X, which is of course much more aerodynamic because of it. I think the Model X gets like a 0.24, which for an SUV is just absolutely insane. And it's also heavy. It's heavy as hell.
Yeah. So you said 5,500.
Yeah, just over 5,500 pounds, which is like the same weight as the Model X, which is bigger. And has more energy capacity inside, like that's like I think 5,500 is equivalent to 100D maybe. I'll have to verify that, but I think it's pretty close to that.
Mm-hmm. So heavier, worse aerodynamics, and then maybe a little bit of technology.
Maybe a little bit of technology, yeah, definitely. And like the pack is heavy. The pack is, I think, the pack alone is 1,500 pounds. But the pack is pretty cool though. With they have the same like skateboard pack that everyone has now. But they did a whole structure of it, so they have an integrated crash structure inside the battery pack in between each modules, which makes the battery pack bigger, makes the battery pack heavier. But I think it's gonna be pretty solid though in terms of safety. We've seen the Model X perform very well in safety with the skateboard pack. Now the Jaguar just today got its 5-star rating in the European crash test. So skateboard design do very well for crash tests. I think Audi might even beat that with their own crash system integrated inside the battery pack. Looks very good, but it is slightly heavier, which result in that efficiency issue that we've been talking about. But that's the thing. So all those compromises, they have their advantages in terms of, like I said, the design. The design just looks awesome. It looks much more accessible, I think, than the Model X for many people, even though I like the design of the Model X, but I can see why some people don't like it. Like, it's definitely a lot more polarizing than the e-tron here.
A question from the comments is, if Tesla could take one thing away from the Audi e-tron, what would it be?
Well, the faster charge rate. Well, so we have to be careful when we see, like, they definitely beat Tesla in charging rate. The charging rate is higher. It's just if you look at miles per minute, Tesla is very close to the e-tron because they're just more efficient. but the actual charge rate is still bigger. So that's where Audi compensate here. But we know that that's coming too. We know that the Model 3 is probably able to have a similar charge rate as the e-tron. It's just that there's other limiting factors right now. And so it's not like Tesla is not aware that you can get a higher charge rate. The design is like I said, it's very solid, but that the design, that's an opinion. Like it depends on for every person. But I think the e-tron is more appealing to a wider audience than the Model X. And yeah, if they have other things to take away from it, I don't know. What do you think?
I don't know. I was thinking interior. Like, you know, some people obviously like the Tesla aesthetic.
Yeah. But
I imagine some, you know, some folks would like the big cushy seats or the with the massage or, you know, maybe some buttons. I don't know.
Yeah, that's really like...
I guess that's Tesla's thing.
But yeah, it depends on every person here. But, I mean, overall, as a whole package, I think it's still a very solid car, despite the efficiency issues, because they still packed a big 95 kilowatt-hour battery pack in there. So you still get around 200 miles of range, which is still good enough for most use case. So when you think about it, at the price range too, which is start about at $75,000 before incentive. So it's not cheap, but if after incentive, after gas savings, it's competitive, which... with a lot of different premium and SUVs here. Not talking about other EVs, just gas-powered car. I think for someone in the market for a premium SUV, gas-powered or electric, I think the e-tron's going to be like the option with the least friction for a lot of people. Like people that just wouldn't buy a Model X because Model X is Tesla. Tesla is a new company. Whatever the design.
Why would you get a e-tron over a I-Pace, for instance?
Similar reason. Like it's bigger. A lot more headroom when you're inside. Feels more spacious. Same thing with the back seat. Looks more like a SUV too. I mean, I think the I-Pace looks awesome, but it's barely an SUV, really.
It's more cross.
Yeah,
whatever it's called,
hatchback crossover, whatever. But definitely, if we're just talking about EVs here, the I-Pace and the e-tron are definitely the closest competitor, I think. The Model X with the option of a third row and everything, I think it's more on a space of its own. But yeah, I think it's gonna get some market shares from a few other gas-powered SUV, premium SUVs. I think, pretty sure.
That's cool. So we're about halfway through the podcast. Any closing words on the Audi? I think we're going to test drive that longer when it comes to the U.S.
Yeah, we should. Well, we need to test drive in the U.S. version too, because there's going to be some differences. Like for example, the roof. We had like a covered roof. Now we're going to I think it's standard in the U.S. It's going to have a glass roof. So that's another big improvement here. And I want to see a full charging cycles from it. There's a bunch of things I want to see and have a longer use case. So we're going to get back to you with the e-tron when it's launched next year. They are aiming for deliveries in Q1 in Europe, Q2 in the US. So 2019 is going to be the year for the e-tron. So yeah, you said we're already halfway through the podcast talking about the e-tron. So we're going to move on real quick with Tesla. Tesla Model 3 mid-range version just got its EPA ratings this week.
Weird.
Yeah, and it is surprising in terms of the efficiency rating. In terms of the range, they got the 260 miles that Tesla promised when they launched the version. But efficiency, they are at 123 mpg, the equivalent of miles per gallon, which is lower than 130 that you get with the long-range rear-wheel drive, because, of course, the mid-range is only available in the rear-wheel drive. So that was surprising to some, because it should be, the only difference should be fewer cells, which means lighter, which should mean normally a little bit more efficient. Of course, if you lose some weight, you lose some force for regen in the city driving, but the city driving definitely got down in terms of efficiency, 136 to 138, 28, I mean. So that was to be expected, but the highway driving also got down significantly from 123 to 117. So I don't know.
Weird.
Yeah.
I mean, they tested on three vehicles, the Model 3 Long Range, and this was just one test vehicle. So maybe that particular vehicle wasn't doing so well.
Yeah, and maybe they don't do all the tests too. Like they did some dyno tests, which is not always representative of real life driving. And then I think a bunch of data is just given from Tesla to the EPA, and then they do their calculations. So maybe there's something with the numbers that just ends up with a lower MPG. But
So they also list 27 kilowatt hours per 100 miles, and that's comparable to the long range, which has 26 kilowatt hours per 100 miles. So it's really not a huge difference. It's one kilowatt hour per 100 miles.
Yeah, yeah. It's not that big of a deal. I just thought it was interesting that.
I was actually hoping like that would be the most efficient car ever.
Yeah, well, we before the mid-range even existed, because like it came as a surprise, really, the mid-range, we thought that the standard battery pack will definitely be. But now, because of it, like it casts some doubt about the standard battery pack being the most efficient car. Though at the same time, the standard battery pack is supposed to be enabled by a new module design, which is supposed to be more efficient. So I still got my hopes up that the standard battery pack Model 3 is going to be the most efficient EV ever made. And if it's the most efficient EV, it's the most efficient car ever made, really.
Yeah, and what also might be interesting about that is if they lower the energy usage of the car, they could theoretically, just to get to that 220 miles, they could theoretically lower the kilowatt hour count of the battery cells from 50 to 48 or something.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Which is how they make it cheaper. Then you reported earlier this week about the launch in Europe. So Tesla opened the Model 3 configurator in Europe.
Yep, another range. So it got 544 kilometers in the WLTP. Is that what it is?
WLTP cycle, yeah.
Yeah, so which is equivalent to about 338 miles. It's pretty far, but that's kind of par for the course. Europe's a pretty forgiving with their mileage.
A lot better than the NEDC, though.
Yeah, the old test NEDC was incredibly long. Like that would have been 400 miles or something crazy.
Yeah, now it's just
now it's just very optimistic.
Like 4 or 5% difference from the EPA, so it's not that big of a.
Yeah. And it opened up in Germany, France, Spain, Sweden, Netherlands, Switzerland, pretty much all of like Western Central Europe. And obviously not the UK because they drive on the other side of the road.
But they did launch a display feed in the UK this week. So like people are hopeful that it should follow very closely after the rest of the European market. Because let's face it, too, the Model 3 should be a pretty easy car to make, ride, and drive, right?
Right. I mean, there's no, you know, you just, I wonder if they're going to switch the display.
Is there even a little angle on the display or not? Like,
no, there's no angle. I mean, I wonder if the part that's on the left side will be on the right side.
Oh, yeah, you have to for sure.
Yeah, that's because
but that's just a software thing. Like, they just mirror the screen and that's it. But yeah, so you reported on a bunch of prices there for all the different markets. So it looks pretty close to what we're expecting in terms of like Tesla's price. Price structure, yeah, so, which is usually
some people were, you know, some outlets were saying it was high because they were based on the base model, but you know, so it was pretty typical.
So only the long range version, all wheel drive, and the performance version are available, right?
Right. There's two models, and not the rear wheel drive and no mid range, but I feel like those are going to come pretty quick afterwards. This is just to, like, if people are on the fence about which one to get, putting this one out there first, higher margins.
Yeah, like you did in the U.S., basically.
Mm-hmm.
Just having the similar launch. Model Y, we got sort of an update from Model Y through a leak that came from Business Insider.
And specifically Lynette Lopez.
Lynette Lopez, which doesn't have a great track record in terms of reporting with Tesla. She's been very negative about Tesla and Tesla disputes.
She's been negative, but her main source previously was that...
That guy who has been leaking some information.
Martin Tripp, I think.
In an allegedly nefarious way, according to the Tesla. But in this case here, so Tesla did dispute the report, but what they did is dispute the timeline and information share, I quote, are outdated. So they didn't dispute that this was actually the plan for the Model Y at some point. So I think it's still valuable information since they didn't want to dispute that. And the information itself, what it is basically the production schedule for the Model Y, which they say that they wanted, at least at some point. They say that the document that date from October is too, so it's not like that whole. A pilot Model Y lined at Gigafactory 1, so that would confirm that Tesla plans to build a Model Y in Gigafactory 1, which has been only rumored until that point, by June 1st, 2020. And they want to ramp up to 2,000 units by September 2020. And a full production rate on that line of 7,000 Model Ys per week by the end of 2020, so by December 2020.
So you should buy property in Reno is the the takeaway.
I mean, they already have 7,000 employees in Gigafactory 1, and there's no vehicle production yet there. Battery production is like at what? 20-30% of the full capacity, 30% of the full capacity they want. This plan should be like a whole city in itself if they indeed plan that kind of capacity there.
It's not just Tesla. It's like all the suppliers. I mean, Tesla is very vertically integrated, but the Model 3 and theoretically the Model Y have been less so. So there's going to be a lot of opportunities for suppliers to set up shop.
Yeah, that's a good point, because that's what happened in Fremont with the Model 3 program, right? When they first announced the Model 3 program there, like a bunch of suppliers ended up buying a ton of real estate or around the Fremont factory. So same thing could happen when if Tesla builds a full vehicle there too. Maybe a few full vehicles there too. We've been talking about Tesla Semi doesn't have its own factory assigned yet. So
And pickups.
At some point, you're going to have to build something else, I assume, like another factory, because that's not...
Maybe they could buy GMs.
Yeah, we've been talking about
that. We're getting ahead of ourselves.
Yeah. Because let's tell Model Y here for a second. They also, the same production schedule, also talk about Gigafactory 3, which we already knew from Tesla's filing in China that they wanted to build the Model Y at Gigafactory 3. They're talking about the 5,000 units per week there by February 2021, but they might have production there too in October 2020. So Gigafactory 3 with the Model Y will follow very soon after the Model 3 there, which they plan to at least partly build as soon as next year there, and will follow also the Model Y in production Gigafactory 1 pretty closely. So we know that China is becoming an increasingly important market for Tesla and for every other automaker, really. So that's important.
Also, Business Insider kind of buried the lead with the most important piece of information was that the Model Y would have a third row seat at least as an option.
That would be crazy, right?
That is crazy.
So, I mean, that wasn't even really a rumor at this point, because it's like
small vehicle.
Yeah, it's still going to be built on the same platform as the Model 3. I mean, you could build a car on the same platform and still have like a slightly different wheelbase, depending on how you set up the car and everything, but it's going to be a pretty cramped third row if there is one, I think.
Yeah, for the kids. Yeah. It's like the Model S rear facing seat.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, they could have a similar design as that. Yeah, that would make more sense. But yeah, apparently in the report they said the third row seat, and they said that the Model 3 platform will only be very slightly updated, raised a little bit for the crossover Model Y, but that they're going to stick to a very similar design and everything in order to bring it to production very fast. So we should know more once they unveil the Model Y, which, as the last information that we have, was March 2019, though that might change, that wasn't set in stone. And at that point, Tesla should also update us with a full production schedule, production plans on confirming if it will indeed be Gigafactory 1 that's going to get that vehicle program. If not, they could just buy a GM plant, like you said. we talked last week about that when GM announced that they are closing down a few assembly plants in North America. We suggested that Tesla should probably just get one of them if they are closing them, because it worked out so well with Fremont Factory, which was partly operated by GM until they closed it in 2010. Tesla bought it from GM and Toyota, and now they are producing cars there at the rate of over 300,000 per year. And so why we are talking about it now is that Elon, in an interview that's going to be published, I think, tomorrow at 60 Minutes. 60 Minutes is on.
Yeah, it's on the weekend.
On the weekend, right? He was asked about that, and he said that yes, it's possible. I'm quoting here. It's possible that we would be interested if GM are going to sell a plant or not use it, that we would take it over. So he's interested, basically. It doesn't mean that's going to happen, but it means that once GM's plant, because GM said that they're going to shut them down next year. Well,
you know, that was kind of weird, because they said they were going to make it, what was the word?
Unallocated. So they won't allocate any vehicle to be produced there.
That almost seemed like it was a bargaining ploy for the unions, almost.
For the unions, and for, in terms of the Canadian plan, probably also like a trade war thing.
Right, government, taxes, all that stuff.
Yeah, they want to put some pressure on the Canadian government, too.
And the way Musk was saying it, he's like, it's not a done deal. It didn't sound like it was a done deal.
Yeah.
So if they do shut those plants down, then we would consider it. But to him, it's not a done deal. It doesn't sound like.
But of course, what's appealing there is that if they do shut them down completely, then you have a huge workforce there that's a skilled workforce at building cars that becomes unemployed. So they're right for the picking in terms of hiring new staff, which you need in bulk. And
you also have the facility, which, exactly. You know, may be kind of, old-fashioned. But in the U.S., it's really hard, like, comparative to China, it's really hard to get all the permits and all the architecture stuff to build a plant. You know, that takes years.
Yeah.
If the plant's already there, you can do pretty much anything you want to it. You can, like, gut it to a skeleton and, put in all new stuff. So that's probably a lot easier, especially in places like Ohio or Canada.
Yeah, and you still have a bunch of machinery too that can still be useful, like stamping and stuff that doesn't evolve as much as some other robotic equipment that you would need that Tesla would want to have for a modern plant. But yeah, there's definitely a lot of infrastructure that they can still use. Yeah, moving on to Tesla's giant battery system in Australia. We've been talking a lot about it, but what happened this week is that we got a pretty extensive report on it that was ordered by Neoen, which is the Tesla's partner in the project. They own the giant wind farm that's next to the system. And what the report said is that it's the estimate that the entire energy storage system managed to save $40 million in cost on the wholesale market in Australia during the first full year of operation. So last week marked the first full year of the operation of they call it the Ornsdale Energy Storage System. That's the 129 megawatt hour power pack system that Tesla deployed in South Australia. And we learned just a few months back from Neoen's quarterly report that the system cost them $66 million from Tesla. So cost them $66 million and made about $40 million.
So it pays off itself in a year and a half.
Yeah, well, that's not so bad. Sounds like it, which is pretty insane.
And you know what's kind of interesting about that, as long as the numbers are public, is a lot of people are going to see those numbers and say, hey, I'll put my money into something that'll,
Yeah, of course.
It'll pay for itself in 2 years.
Yeah, it paid for itself in 2 years in South Australia, which has a pretty crazy energy market where prices are very high. And the service that it's performing, the FCAS, Frequency Management Service, that's the highest cost thing. So they reduce that by 70 to 90% depending on the market. So it's pretty impressive cost difference. But year and a half, even if it's the market is not as good in some players, and it's 3 years, it's still a very good investment when you have a 3 year return on investment or something that big. I mean, it's still going to work for years and years after that. So you're just racking up money at that point, which is nice. Still, on the Tesla energy storage front, there was also some development on the virtual power plant, because I mean, we're talking about 100 megawatt to 100 megawatt slash 129 megawatt hour energy storage system with the power pack. That's going to be dwarfed still in Southern Australia with the virtual power plant system that Tesla is deploying there. They had when they announced that earlier this year, they were deploying the first 100 station, 100. I don't know if it's 100 power pack, but it's 100 homes. They did 100 homes. I don't know if they do one power pack per home, power wall, excuse me, per home, or if it's more than one. But they did the first 100, and now they're moving on to the second phase where they're going to deploy a thousands of them. But the ultimate goal is 50,000 of them, which is going to make for a giant virtual power plant. And some homes are already seeing the difference. I mean, the what was the coolest thing about this thing, about this project, is that we're not talking at the utility level where we're seeing the cost benefit or the giant utility. The home, the households are seeing the cost improvement here, or seeing the savings directly, because the government is financing the system, and they are financing them for low-income household. And we were just talking about how the energy prices are crazy in South Australia. So it's a necessity, the electricity. So it's a cost that you're going to have to pay every month. And when you have a low income, it makes a big dent in your budget. So if we look here, they spoke with some of the first people that got their installation, and they saw in the first quarter where they were paying the energy bill per quarter. Normally it was over $500. And since they got the solar system with Powerwall, it got down to $175. So that's, you're saving basically over $100 per month. So for a low-income family, that's a big, big difference. And first 100 homes got that. Now they're gonna have 1,000 more homes that are gonna get similar system installed. So they're gonna see those savings too. And then after those 1,000 homes, the other 49,000 or so, then it's gonna be open to not just people with low income, but the broader market itself. So it's gonna have a wider impact.
Yeah, I mean, power walls make a lot of sense for any, just about anywhere that has high demand pricing. For instance, like we have a place in Vermont, and the price of electricity doubles during the day. And you know, we did some math, and like even just one power wall up there,
which is 14 kilowatt hour capacity.
Yeah, which is, you know, probably more than a day's capacity for us, would, you know, offset the cost. I mean, it, you know, we end up paying like 70 or 80 bucks a month. It's just a very small place. But, you know, just over the period of a year, I think we would save about half of what we pay in electricity, probably more than that. So, like, these things really pay for themselves quite quickly if you have the disparity in electricity pricing. And even better, like, not everybody will do this, but if it can actually fill up with electricity during the low period, and then not only output to you, fill up your house and pay off your house, but also send some back to the grid at a higher rate, you know, if the electricity company and the net metering works that way, then you can actually make money on the, like, your bills are actually negative or zero or whatever.
Yeah, that's the dream.
That's the dream. But it's not crazy. I mean, there's a lot of things that these things can kind of make happen that really nobody really thought of, and they're not crazy expensive.
Yeah, they did increase in price a little bit earlier this year, but it comes with new hardware and everything, so that it compensates a little bit. Moving on from Tesla, well, not completely really. The Boring Company, Elon announced yesterday that they're going to push the unveiling of the first proof of concept tunnel that they dug under Hawthorne in near Los Angeles by a week to the December 18. But that's because they're gonna be it's not gonna be a surprise anymore that they're gonna unveil what Elon referred to as a fully road legal autonomous transport car. If you're looking at my screen right now, if you're listening on YouTube, we're looking at the it was part of the, like, when they launched a video of they launched a Boring Company concept with the ad, some kind of a car that was completely made of glass, and it goes inside the tunnels, but it looks like it could also go on the road. So we assume that he's talking about that. But he referred to it as a modded but fully road legal autonomous car. So he also said before then, didn't say that yesterday, but before that, he said that Tesla would build those pods. He referred to them as pods. He said that Tesla would build those pods. So it sounds like it's some kind of modded Tesla vehicle that could drive on the road fully autonomously. So I don't know. It's not weird because Tesla doesn't have a fully autonomous concept that is legal on the public road, especially not in California. They don't even want to test their fully self-driving cars in California because they don't like the reporting system that they have to do in California. We famously learned that when they did the original demo in 2016, that was the only reported mileage that they had in California's self-driving test program. So I don't know what he's talking about exactly with that.
Yeah, and so this thing is, the event is in 11 days, and we don't even have much info on it. I'm not sure if we're going to get invited or not. I don't know if invitations have gone out.
Yeah, if you remember, guys, because of the ads, contest with the Boring Company, we won that contest because I bought a bunch of hats, and we got to visit that tunnel that they just completed. When we visited, it was like 75% completed or something earlier this summer. But we couldn't film anything. We couldn't take pictures. They asked us even also to not talk about it and everything publicly. So they did say that once they're going to announce it publicly, they're going to re-invite us so that we can talk about it with you guys. But we didn't get any information since then. So we'll see.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see what this Tesla-built pod
looks like. I have a feeling it's not going to be much like the concept that we saw.
It's probably not going to be like that, but I wonder if it's going to be anything like the, you know, they've talked about microbuses and they've talked about other kind of vehicles. You know, is it going to be semi, like the Tesla semi base? Is it going to be like a bus?
Hey, you were in that tunnel. Tesla semi wouldn't fit in there.
No, it's not going to be like that. No. But I mean, maybe the, you know, engine wise.
Yeah, the platform, like the platform. Yeah, maybe.
Yeah.
But even then, that's also large. I mean, you look at the Model X. They put the Model X through it, and that was it.
Like, pretty tight.
Yeah. It was tight.
It'll probably be an elongated Model X or something. Yeah. Or it'll probably just be a Model X.
Probably. Yeah. Then, quickly, we still have a few minutes. SK Innovation announced a new electric vehicle battery gigafactory, this time in the U.S. So you know SK Innovation from South Korea. They supply Hyundai and Kia and Mercedes and a bunch of automakers for the electric vehicles. And they expanded earlier this year in Europe. What is it? Is it Hungary?
I think they're the biggest battery company that a lot of people have never heard of.
Yeah, yeah. And people know LG
and Samsung. And
yeah, exactly. People know LG. People know
Panasonic, Samsung. Sony, all those.
But SK is like, those are in terms of production capacity, they are over SK. But SK is catching up with, they have their new battery gigafactory in Hungary under construction. And now they announced one in the U.S. It's going to be in Georgia, in Jackson County, Georgia. They didn't confirm the capacity of it, but we've been calling it a gigafactory, like we call any battery factory that has a gigawatt hour annual production capacity. So basically Tesla came up with that term that we've been using for other factory with similar capacity in terms of annual production. And again, they didn't confirm the annual production, but they did confirm an investment of $1.6 billion. So it's certainly going to be in the gigawatt hour capacity. But, like, maybe, I don't know, 10, 20, which is still a lot.
Yeah, so And Jackson, Georgia is kind of like an exurb of Atlanta, kind of on the way to Savannah. So,
yeah, there's a bunch of other automakers there, right?
I think so.
Yeah. Well, also in other states close to Georgia, like Tennessee and stuff. But they didn't name Mercedes-Benz and Hyundai Kia. They said that those are the customers that motivated them to build a factory there. So we know that Mercedes-Benz is going to produce EVs in the U.S. They confirmed that with the EQC program. Hyundai and Kia, though, that's a first for me to hear about them bringing EV production to the U.S. Finally, on a fun note, Aston Martin. We don't talk a lot about Aston Martin and electric because they don't have much going on in terms of electrification. They have that Rapid He that's coming. I think it's coming as soon as next year, but we haven't been very excited about it because, well, Aston Martin is not a big manufacturer, but even by their standard, the Rapid E is a small program with just 155 limited production plan. But they're going to have something new. They leverage what they learned from building the powertrain for the Rapid E, which, if you remember, at some point was in partnership with Faraday Future.
Oops.
But I think they dropped that along the way and during one of Faraday Future's mini crisis.
Yeah.
But now they do have that car coming next year, and they're going to have also a EV conversion program for classic cars. So they call it the Heritage EV. They started with a 1970 DB6 MK2 Volante. Is that how you pronounce that? Volante?
I think so.
Volante, which is classic car that they put the powertrain in it. They didn't release any spec for the powertrain, unfortunately, but they said they managed to keep the exact classic look of the car. So sort kind of a retro mod where everything looks stock, but they have a brand new powertrain underneath it that's fully electric, and they say that they're able to package that and make it so that it's going to be replicable for other classic vehicle, and they're going to offer it as an EV conversion package for classic car owners. And that sounds awesome, and which I find very cool. It looks like it's becoming a trend directly Jaguar. From automakers, because you see Jaguar also offering a similar system for the E-Type. Which one?
I think it's E-Type, yeah. But I think it's because some places in Europe, city centers, aren't allowing older vehicles inside the city. So if you want to actually be able to drive your car inside the city, you need to electrify it.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah. They say that it's about keeping the whole car future-proof and relevant, so that would work with that logic. It's something that a bunch of individuals have been doing for years. I mean, we've been reporting about some cool EV conversions now for years, but it looks like actual automakers are catching up and making it into a service, which should, I mean, it's still Aston Martin, it's still Jaguar, but it might reduce the price at some point because an EV conversion are extremely expensive. And if you can make it in series, basically make the actual packages of the powertrain in series production, then you reduce the cost of that. Still, the labor costs are an important part of an EV conversion, but I'm hopeful that it should not be too outrageous in terms of pricing. All right. That's pretty much it, guys, for this week's Electric Podcast. We're going to be back next week, same time, same place, with a ton of more news as usual. And in the meantime, take care. Bye-bye.